We're going to open the Rules Committee this date on the 2nd of February. And with that, we're going to rearrange the order that you received, and we're going to have up first HGR 8. So we're going to open a public hearing on HGR 8, and we have available to us today. Representative Olson. Did you want anybody else to come up with you? Oh, okay.
Looks like the left to me, sir.
It looks very much like the
actually, that would be the far left.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is truly an honor to be in front of you. I think this is the first time ever in my three sessions here that I've been in front of rules. Oh, no, I take that back one other time. But House Joint Resolution 8 recognizes President Abraham Lincoln's involvement in the development of the Oregon Territory. Once you hear the following information I'm going to share with you, I believe you will unanimously support the declaration honoring President Lincoln as honorary territorial governor come February 12th of this year. First bullet, I'll go through some of these quickly. I know that you can read, but first point, in 1849, the incoming administration of President Zachary Taylor offered Abraham Lincoln the governorship of the Oregon Territory. It was something I wasn't aware of, but I thought it was rather unique. And then third bullet there was kind of interesting. Had Lincoln accepted the appointment to the U.S. territory that Zachary Taylor wanted him to do, you can imagine how history would have been changed with him being here rather than being back on the east side of the states. 11 of Oregon's 36 counties have geographic names with direct links to Lincoln and the Civil War. While Lincoln is primarily remembered for his role during the Civil War, he was a supporter of several major pieces of legislation that helped form the state. Morrill Land Grant Act, this is an act responsible for founding of Oregon State University. Transcontinental Rail Act, this act helped establish the Coast-to-Coast Railroad that opened up the West and Oregon. And the Homestead Act, this act allowed land to settlers in the West and Oregon. And finally, the original Oregon Territory consisted all of our parts of the states of Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. Resolutions similar to HJR 8 are currently being introduced through those states in legislation. And as we move forward, our plan is to have and hope that all these resolutions be passed on the same day, the bicentennial date of February 12th of this year. So I'm here today to ask that you recognize the contributions of Abraham Lincoln made to this state and to our nation with this resolution.
Questions of our witness? Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Olson, have you had the opportunity to talk to Mr. Lincoln about this and see how he feels about this proposal?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gelser, negative.
Thank you.
Representative Edwards.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Olson, I assume that there's no problem if Oregon were to go on its own and as a part of the Western Lincoln Initiative proposed before us, and other states did not adopt the Western Lincoln Initiative, would we be at risk in any way of being out there on our own?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative C. Edwards, I will assure your safety should that occur.
Questions. So, do our good Senate colleagues have an opportunity to vote on?
Good question, Mr. Chair. A similar Senate joint resolution is occurring and will happen at the same date and same time over there on their side.
Okay. Other questions for our witness? Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very kindly.
I see no other people have signed up. Is there anyone else here who wishes to speak to House Joint Resolution 8? Seeing none, we will close the hearing on House Joint Resolution 8. And we have another series of bills, all of which were introduced by our Secretary of State's office. And so my inclination right now is to open up hearings on all of them so people can speak in general again. Is there any?
I think you should probably go be with individual district.
Okay. Okay. And take the testimony one at a time?
Right. Open them and close them.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to go right through it. So let's, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2084. You and away you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Barry Packer. I'm the Deputy Secretary of State. And I won't take up much of your time. I just wanted to come before you and thank you for hearing these bills. You'll notice a common theme is that they were all introduced at the request of Secretary of State Bill Bradbury. But while they were drafted and filed by the previous administration, they all have the full support of Secretary Brown, and she and I thank you for hearing them today and hope you will act on them in due course. And unless the committee has any questions specifically for me, I'll happily, with your permission, return to the audience and turn it over to Peter Threlkell, our expert on all of these bills.
That's great.
Thank you.
Peter.
Thank you. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peter Threlkell. I'm the director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's office, and I'm here to talk to you today about House Bill 2084. This is a bill that we really came up with in some of our discussions internally on how the division could manage its costs better. The division currently manages the Uniform Commercial Code program, and out of that, creditors throughout the state are able to file what's known as a Uniform Commercial Code financing statement. It's a 5-year term on the statement, and basically what this does is if you were to loan money on real estate, that deed would be recorded at the county courthouse. If you were to loan money on a vehicle that's titled through the Department of Motor Vehicles, the title would have a security interest placed on the vehicle to make sure that you, the creditor, were able to get repaid or collect on that collateral at some point. Pretty much everything else that doesn't involve real estate or doesn't involve titles at DMV is known as personal property, and that property you can have a security interest or collateral placed on that. You do so by filing the financing statement with my office. What that does for a creditor is it allows them to establish their position in line in case a debtor were to enter into bankruptcy, and they would hold their position versus other creditors. And our system is really a public notice so that any other creditors can come along and they can check the system to see does Joe Smith owe anybody else for this farm implement or riding lawnmower or jet ski or whatever the collateral happens to be. So it's really a system that that benefits creditors and provides additional access to credit for borrowers and debtors. Within the system, we mail every 2 years or biennium, we mail out 66,000 renewal notices that go out to the secured parties to basically alert them that the 5-year term is about to expire and that they have the option to go ahead and renew that financing statement for another 5-year period. When we looked at this, we looked at the costs. We're currently spending about $22,500 in postage expense during the biennium. The prices that we pay there are set by the U.S. Post Office, and they just keep going up every year. As we looked at areas within our budget that we can trim or try to become more efficient, this is immediately off the table because it's a statutory requirement to send the notice. Also, in looking at the activities of other states, Oregon is the only state that requires this renewal notice. All states have adopted what's known as the Revised Model Act, and it's a uniform act for UCC. The goal is that all states are as uniform as possible so that those businesses that are doing business in multiple states don't have to relearn a new set of laws. So really, I think that our point is the concept behind the renewal notice goes back many decades to a time when technology was expensive for private businesses and individuals. It was made more sense for the state to manage that process through its own systems internally. And since that time, we've all seen decreases in technology, advances in the systems and opportunities that are available to people. And this is just one area that we thought would be worth looking at and maybe bringing an end to the requirement. So,
okay.
That, if you had any questions.
Questions for our witness? Seeing none, thank you very much. We did have one other person sign up, Sam Sears.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Sam Sears. I'm an attorney in private practice in Kaiser. I'm a member of the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar, and I'll keep my comments really short. I noted on the sign-up statement that I have written testimony. I do not have written testimony to turn in. I just wanted to come up here and express that the debtor-creditor section had some concerns with this particular bill, and I've contacted Mr. Threlkell and Mr. Pack. And maybe there's a way that we can communicate and work out some agreement, something like email notices or something of that nature that might alleviate their concerns and also address ours. So with that, I don't have any other comments that I want to give to the committee.
Okay. Any questions for the witness? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who has comments to make to House Bill 2084? Seeing none, we're going to close our hearing on 2084. And that's true. I don't know how to And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2085. And I guess we'll start first with a introductory comments by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. This measure changes the list of documents in ORS 194.515 upon which a notary may rely in identifying persons. It does so by adding a current driver's license or current identity card issued by any state, a current U.S. passport, a current officially recognized passport of a foreign country, a current U.S. military identification card, or a current identity card issued by a federally recognized tribe. It deletes use of documents containing only the person's signature, including use of financial institution signature cards. In terms of background, under the current law, acceptable identification documents that a notary public may accept when identifying a signer require either a person's photograph, signature, and physical description, or two documents bearing a person's signature. Proponents assert that the existing statute, ORS 194.515, has not kept pace with new forms of identification, which may create a higher assurance of a person's identity, although not providing the required physical description or signature. Proponents further assert that Oregon notaries are not currently able to accept many U.S. military identification cards or recent passports issued by the United States government as proof of a person's identity without also requiring the person to present some other form of identification. That's my summary.
Thank you very much. And with that, our next testimony.
Thank you. Do I need to reintroduce myself on the...
You do.
Okay. Well, we'll do that. So, Chair Roblin, members of the committee, again, I'm Peter Threlkeld, Director of the Corporation Division. This is a bill that really came out from a number of complaints from notaries public that as they're out there around the state doing their duties to verify the identity of signers, we started to hear back that members of the active military or people who were presenting what they thought was a high assurance form of identification, like a new U.S. passport, the notary was not able to accept that information, even though we can document that the U.S. military and the U.S. State Department have a very rigorous process to make sure that their newer forms of identification really do attest to the identity of the person. And the change there was that a lot of those forms of identification started to omit a physical description of the person. If you get a passport 10 years ago, a lot of times your physical description may change over time. And so I think they felt that that wasn't necessary to leave on the face of the document. Also, these new forms of technology include whether it's a RFID chip or some magnetic strip that contains additional information. Of course, that information is only available through an appropriate or approved type of reader, which most of Oregon's notaries would not have access to. The notaries were really faced with having to turn people away or having to ask them to go get additional pieces of information. Current law allows that the notary may accept two forms of identification that are issued by a business. So while they couldn't accept a U.S. passport, they could accept a Bi-Mart card and possibly a Costco card. And so a little bit of irony in that we have much higher standards and that are more stringent in gaining the federal identification, and now many state driver's license identifications have higher standards, but we would allow a notary to identify someone based on a business identification that really didn't have a lot of additional thought behind it or criteria. So what we're looking to do is update in statute those forms of ID that a notary can accept. We want to make sure that the passports are accepted, that military ID is accepted, that any ID issued by a federally recognized tribe is accepted, and also any state ID that or actually any government ID that does include a person's physical description, photograph, and signature would also be accepted. And we ask that the state delete those other forms of identification that really only rely on a signature or some other lesser form of evidence. With that, if you have any questions.
Okay. Representative Grard.
I don't have a copy of the bill in front of me, but when you refer to a passport or a driver's license, does the bill itself say valid driver's license or passport or current?
Chair Roblin, George. The bill refers to a current passport, driver's license, or identification card. One other thing that I would add, the Oregon Bankers Association, when we talked to them, they were supportive of the bill, and they did suggest that we might want to ask for amendment to include the new U.S. passport card. It's a driver's license card, and I think that has come out since the time that we had asked for the bill to be drafted. So it's really just a variation of the passport, but for somebody that's going to travel domestically, getting on a plane, you could use that as opposed to carrying around your passport book. And we would support that idea.
Other questions? Yes.
Well, I'm getting back to current versus valid. I don't know what the legal definition of current is. I guess if it isn't current, it's invalid. Am I assuming correctly there? And I don't mean to be nitpicking here. But
sure, and I would agree with that. And so for current, we would interpret that as not expired. So as the driver's license is valid for, I believe, 4 or 8 years, if you haven't renewed it or maintained that status, we would expect that an expired driver's license would not be acceptable.
Thank you.
Other questions? I have a question. I worry about any of these when we start putting particular documents into the definition, and then something else comes up that we think is good, we come back and have to change it. Is there a way to say official document of the federal government or state government in such a way that is it in here enough that, for example, the one you just mentioned, is it covered by the definition?
Chair Roblin, yes. We did ask to have a section in here that if a person presents an additional form of identification issued by a government, whether that's federal, state, local, in those cases, it just needs to have the physical description, a signature, and a photograph.
Okay. Representative Berger.
You know, I'm looking at the building. And I have the same kind of problem with the word current over the word valid.
Okay.
And I guess I would like you to indulge us a little bit and go back and talk to either LC or your own attorneys about the difference that might be inherent in those two. Because I think what we were talking about here is valid, not current. And I guess I'd like to kind of pursue it just a little bit with the legal minds.
Okay.
If it would make me feel better.
Chair Roblin, you know. Representative Berger, we'd be happy to do that.
Thank you very much. We can check on that as well. Any other questions? Seeing none, there was no one else that had signed up. Is there anyone in present who would like to speak to House Bill 2085? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2085, and we will open a hearing on House Bill 2086. Public hearing, and we'll start with an explanation by our administrator.
Chair Roblin, members.
No problem. You're good.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. This bill allows Secretary of State to waive the requirement for administratively dissolved nonprofit corporations to apply for reinstatement within 5 years from the date of dissolution. Currently, Oregon corporations, including nonprofit corporations, must file annual reports with the Secretary of State. If filing requirements are not met, a nonprofit corporation may be administratively dissolved by the Secretary of State. Oregon law allows an administratively dissolved corporation 5 years to request reinstatement. Reinstatement nullifies the administrative dissolution retroactively, as if the dissolution didn't happen. Nonprofit corporations who do not seek reinstatement within 5 years cannot be reinstated. Proponents assert that many nonprofit corporations are relatively small, run by volunteers, experience frequent turnover of officers, and that new officers are sometimes not aware of annual filing requirements. Recent changes in federal tax law now require that most small nonprofits to file annual tax reports with the Internal Revenue Service. Proponents assert that this has caused many nonprofits to discover that their corporation status was dissolved more than 5 years ago, and that concerns have been raised about the status of tax-exempt donations received by such corporations, as well as the control and transfer of assets belonging to the nonprofit corporation. This proposal allows the Secretary of State to waive the requirement that administratively dissolved nonprofit corporations apply for reinstatement within 5 years from the date of dissolution. Proponents assert that these concerns listed above would be eliminated through reinstatement. That's my report.
Okay. With that, We have an opportunity to hear one more time from the Secretary of State's office.
Chair Rogland, members of the committee, again, Peter Threlkeld, Director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's office. This one really came about, House Bill 2086, as Jerry stated, because of the changes in IRS requirements. They used to require that a small nonprofit, which was any nonprofit that had less than $25,000 a year in donations, did not have to file annual tax statements. That changed as of the 2008 tax year, so we're starting to see a number of nonprofits all of a sudden discovering that they were inactivated many years ago. The situation with the nonprofits is very unique in that when they hold their annual meeting, a lot of times the people that have been serving as officers are ready to let someone else step forward and take over those responsibilities. The vast majority of these folks are volunteer. They're not paid. Very many of them, because of the short tenure that you would have as an officer, never really have an opportunity to gain training or experience and really fully understand the duties that that they're really signing on for as they're out in our communities trying to provide additional support and strengthen our communities in many different areas. So the problems that we've heard is that while somebody that goes beyond the five-year period, they may be able to come back and form a new corporation, and that's basically what we're having to tell them is their option now. That really raises a number of questions for them. What do they do with the assets of the old corporation? What do they do with any tax receipts that they maybe wrote to people who they felt that, you know, here we are, we're still an ongoing nonprofit corporation. They were just unaware that they were dissolved. As well as any issues that they might run into with the Internal Revenue Service. This situation really is unique to the nonprofits, and as most business corporations and limited liability companies have a lot more stability, the officers there are able to deal with our office on an ongoing basis, and they, you know and expect that we're going to have an annual report due this time next year. And so they're into more of a routine where the nonprofits really never get that opportunity. The notices that we mail out with the for the annual report, a lot of times they go to the officer that was on record. Usually it was the person that's no longer filling the duties. A lot of times they fail to hand that information off to the new officers, and so we really see a lot more gap here, a lot more exposure, a lot more opportunity for nonprofits to fail to renew and thus become administratively dissolved. I would say that the change in the law that limited it to 5 years was actually a bill that our office had requested back in 1995, and it was to deal with a problem that was going on at the time. Primarily it dealt with, well, actually exclusively, it dealt with private businesses that were over 100 years old, old Oregon Railroad and Mining Companies, that had been inactive for at least a period of 50 years. We were dealing with some unscrupulous individuals out of California that were coming in. They were doing the research. After they got the research from our office on these old expired companies, they'd come back and they'd request to reinstate them. Once they were reinstated, they'd change the name to something a little bit more modern, maybe not referring to a mining company or a railroad. And then they would turn around and they would sell them as 100-year-old shelf companies to allow somebody to set up shop and pretend that they were an ongoing business that had been around since early statehood. The agency felt that that was a deceptive practice that really led and misled consumers. That was where it was House Bill 2219 came into play. That was approved. And that's been very effective with the controlling that practice on the private business side. The problem is that a nonprofit doesn't have owners, so you couldn't sell an old nonprofit. It wouldn't benefit anybody. I don't know why we didn't think to exclude them then, but we would like to come back and fix that now. So I think we'd be able to help a lot of our small nonprofits fix some problems they have, help them avoid some very expensive legal bills, I think, to unravel some of these situations. So with that, if you have any questions.
Questions? Yes, Representative Gelsinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to say I think this is a great bill. I serve on the board of a nonprofit that I founded about 10 years ago, and we serve hundreds of families throughout the United States, entirely volunteer board. We've never paid anyone anything, but the officership rotates and often rotates to people in other parts of the country as well. So that challenge of the new person understanding how to file that report, to get the information, to fill out the report, the number of hours they're volunteering each month and get it in on time, is a real challenge for these very small boards that are only, you know, moving hundreds of dollars in and out over the course of a year. It'll really help a lot of people.
Other questions? I concur, having been involved in a couple of nonprofits myself and recognizing the 25,000 barrier and having come up against us being a treasurer when we actually exceeded that and for the first time and then started having to, I think the changes at the IRS level are better too, because if you start from the very beginning knowing you're going to do this, it's a much nicer than when you get in the job all of a sudden and you're the first one that has to figure out that you need to file. So I think those are, it gets people in used to doing it. I mean, I think everyone, the bylaws require you to have the annual meeting and they require you to have to fill out the form, but I think as time gets on, people forget to look at some of the other stuff at the state level. So this will be good. Any other questions of our witness? Seeing none. Again, no one else has signed up. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to speak to House Bill 2086? Yes, question, Representative Edwards.
By getting rid of this requirement, will you be able to save any money? I'm looking for every penny. you said $22,500 on House Bill 2084, 2085 in postage. If we find 10 million more of those, we can fill the hole. So I'm looking for...
Representative Edwards, we're looking for every penny too. Actually, I think what in my fiscal impact, I'm estimating that we'll increase revenue by about $10,000 per biennium. That's a very conservative number, I think. In order to reinstate, what you have to do is you have to come back in and you have to make an application. You have to pay all of the back annual fees. So a corporation that has been inactive for 5 years would pay us $250 to reinstate. A corporation that's been inactive for 20 years is going to pay us substantially more versus their other option is to just come and register a new corporation and pay $50. So I think we have an opportunity to allow to help some people out, but also allow them to make up all those back years that that they didn't pay the fee, and bringing that back in. I wouldn't count on this to fix the revenue problems for the state.
$999,900.
Okay, seeing no one else testify and no further questions, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2086, and we will open a hearing on House Bill 2087, and we'll have a statement from our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. This measure prohibits the Secretary of State from charging fees to file annual report for nonprofit corporations where the articles of incorporation provide that the purpose is to maintain historic cemeteries, and that the cemetery is also listed with the Oregon Commission on Historic Cemeteries. Under Oregon law, historic cemetery must have at least one burial of a person who died before February 14, 1909, in other words, within 50 years of statehood, and be listed with the Oregon Commission on Historic Cemeteries, which is part of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. The Commission's website contains a 31-page list of historic cemeteries throughout Oregon. According to proponents, most historic pioneer cemeteries are private, except only limited burials, if any. We rely mostly on small donations for maintenance, and some are organized as nonprofit corporations. Nonprofit corporations are required to pay a $50 annual reporting fee. Proponents assert that the $50 annual fee creates a hardship for many small historic cemeteries. The Secretary of State's office presently waives fees on a case-by-case basis and proposes to eliminate this requirement for certain historic cemeteries.
Thank you very much. So with that, I think we'll invite the Secretary of State's office.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Peter Drockel. I'm the director of the Corporation Division, here to speak with you about House Bill 2087. This bill has kind of been in the works for a number of years, and it really first came to the forefront about 2004 when the fee to renew a corporation was increased from $20 to $50. We really started to hear from a lot of the historic cemeteries that this really was creating a burden. There were a lot of them that the information that they provided to us was that they were very small cemeteries and that their total annual budget for maintenance for many of them was $50, and that would be to buy gas to help preserve the gravestones and other information that really dealt back to our early pioneer heritage. So we've worked with State Parks and Historic Cemeteries Commission off and on over the last couple of years and trying to come up with what would be a better long-term solution. We do, on a case-by-case basis, as we have the authority, waive the filing fee or the annual report fee. But what we would like to do is implement a more permanent solution during the 150th anniversary of Oregon statehood as a way to honor the folks that were our early pioneers and help those out, those primarily volunteers that are working to preserve that history for us. So as we've gone through, I think there are about 700 historic cemeteries listed with the commission. There are 150 of those are registered as nonprofit corporations, and that's really what we see as the population that could be impacted by this. That would be a reduction in revenue of about $15,000 a biennium. Out of that, I would just say that the division currently generates a little in excess of $30 million a biennium. So I believe there's some folks from the Cemetery Commission that were here to testify as well, but if you have any other questions?
Yeah, we'll go for some questions. Representative Garrard.
Thank you. This is a bill that's simply going to eliminate a $50 fee for historic cemeteries, basically.
That is correct.
It's the only thing it does. My question to you is, will this open the door to other, how many other type of cemeteries are there in the state that might qualify under similar conditions? I'm trying to preserve some of the money that the good representative Eugene is spending.
So there are a number of other cemeteries which are nonprofit cemeteries. They're just not historic ones, correct?
That is correct. Chair Roblin, Representative Gerard, I think it's a little too late for anybody to try to meet the requirements of being a historic cemetery because the folks had to have been buried over 100 years ago.
That's good reasoning.
So I think that, you know, we might see more... We might see more of the cemeteries choosing to become a nonprofit corporation as a way to help preserve those grave sites and those plots of land long term.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow up.
The reason I'm going at this is that in Klamath Falls, the city of Klamath Falls, which presently owns the cemetery, is trying to sell it to a private entrepreneur, and there are people in that cemetery, buried prior to 1909. So my question, I'm trying to tie the two together, and I don't know if I can.
Chair Robland, Representative Turrett, I think I understand. So if a private business were to purchase a cemetery and they're organized as a private business, they would not qualify under this bill. They would have to be a nonprofit corporation.
Quick follow-up, not to waste anybody's more time on this, but they could then apply for a historic cemetery designation.
They could register part of their property as a nonprofit corporation, or as a, they could register as a nonprofit corporation, and that would exclude, you know, that part of their business from the fee.
Okay.
But if they're also registered as a private profit corporation, because the owners want to get paid those profits out of the corporate business, that would have to be separate from the nonprofit corporation side that they may also.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Cemeteries are losing money everywhere. They're cost factors. So this is a good bill in that it does help certain areas.
Other questions? Representative Berger.
We aren't going to make comments about dead bills and that kind of thing. But I do want to clarify what you just said was, I'm reading from your testimony, the Oregon Commission on Historic Cemeteries lists 700 historic cemeteries, but there are only 150 that are registered in nonprofits, and so it's only this 150 that would qualify under this bill, not the 700.
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, currently it would be the 150. To clarify that, the other 550, they would have the opportunity to choose, if they decided to form a nonprofit corporation. That would then include them in that fee waiver. But at present, they have not registered as nonprofit corporations or created a nonprofit corporation for whatever reason. My understanding is that some of those 700 represent a single gravesite, and it's part of a vast tract of land, and it's just where, you know, I think during the pioneer days when somebody passed away, the family buried them wherever they could or on the homestead, and so those are really the part of the history of Oregon that the commission is looking to protect, and we're looking to help them out.
Thank you. That clarifies a lot. Now I have a visual of what we're trying to do here. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Other questions? Okay. Seeing none, we do have a few other people, and if both would like to come up, Judy and Carol, you're certainly welcome to come on up. And there's two chairs. Flank the Secretary of State's office. And be sure to, you know, acknowledge who you are and so on, and we would love to hear your testimony.
All right. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Judy Breitkraft Gentleman. I'm the chair of the Oregon Commission for Historic Cemeteries, and the commission supports this bill. We support it because $50 for those historic cemeteries that are nonprofit often is half or a quarter of their budget. Many of these cemeteries were given to the community as burying grounds, and it is these community volunteers who've stepped forward to care for the cemeteries. I always like to tell the story about the gentleman from Monroe who could find no one to be the sexton of the cemetery, and so when he died at over 100, he was still the sexton and still doing pretty well. So a lot of times also the caretakers of the cemetery are older, and it's a real challenge for them to come up with funds, and some of the cemeteries are no longer being used. In order to get this benefit, the cemetery has to be listed with the Oregon Commission on Historic Cemeteries. And we're hopeful that this will encourage some more cemeteries to take the benefits of the commission because we've been working really hard to help historic cemeteries preserve their heritage. The cost of cemeteries is rising, and it's true. Cemeteries are losing money. Vandalism is also an increasing problem. Believe it or not, what they call white bronze or the zinc stones, metal stones, are very vulnerable because of the metal increase of demand for metal. So we are hopeful that this bill will pass and help these struggling cemeteries to continue to do the work that they do because this is a very important part of our past, and it would be a shame to lose those cemeteries. Many of them have fallen into disuse, and that's when a lot of these people got involved, was they decided they wanted to take care of the cemetery, and they went forth and did that. So we're hopeful that this bill will pass.
We'll have testimony from both of you, and then we'll open for questions.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'm Carol Serency, and I'm president of the Oregon Historic Cemeteries Association, which is a nonprofit organization with statewide roots. We publish a newsletter that goes out statewide, and our purpose is to educate people and to provide a network system for people who are interested in historic cemeteries and to provide education about their benefit. I'm just going to repeat, so I will be short, the points that Judy's already made. The people that do this do it for love and for respect, and many times they do a lot of it out of their own pockets. I can think of one example in Washington County where I live of a lady who is taking care of and has for a number of years a small cemetery of, I don't know, maybe 30, maybe a quarter of an acre and 30 or 40 burials there. And these are pioneer people who came in the donation land claim days originally. The earliest burials are those. None of the people in that cemetery are her ancestors, although she has others in the county, other cemeteries in the county where she does have ancestors. But it was a very neglected cemetery. She was afraid that Highway 26 was going to impinge on it, and so she took responsibility for it and gathered up a couple of other people to be a part of an association. Their budget is about $200 a year. So for them, when this raised from $20 to $50, that was a quarter of their budget. So it became kind of a big deal. So because of that, and because I know that there are many other cemeteries and people who are working with them around the state who are facing the same kind of situation, would really appreciate your consideration of this bill.
Thank you very much. Questions for Representative Edwards?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is a little bit, well, not a little bit, it's completely tangential. But I'm just wondering, as we've been talking about this, what happens if a cemetery is on is registered as a historic cemetery with the Secretary of State, and say there's just one person there, there's a big, I don't know, shopping mall or something that somebody wants to develop right there. Does this designation as a historic cemetery, how does that play out with development? You know, building new roads
and to the development.
Yeah,
I was just curious.
But the commission has actually worked with, I think it was the hospital in Eugene when they found. They found human remains, and they were historic, and they made arrangements working with the commission. But it can. I mean, it doesn't matter whether they're historic or prehistoric. If they find human remains, it stops the project until they can solve the problem. So
okay.
I can give you a good example from Washington County. Again, there's a large biotech company that's just come in, just recently started there, but it was delayed for a couple of years in this 40-acre field because there's some evidence to suggest that Joe Meek's wife and a couple of his children and maybe a couple of other Native Americans were buried in the field. So they had to really go through with the ground-penetrating radar and do the whole archaeological process before they could go ahead and build exactly where they wanted to build.
Yeah. Okay. Other questions?
Yes.
Representative Nolan.
Do these individual nonprofits own the land that these cemeteries occupy, or who owns the property?
Go ahead.
Well, sometimes they do, but most often they don't. The land very often has been set aside as a cemetery in a deed somewhere. Mm-hmm. And they just take over the administration of that particular cemetery, become the friends of that particular cemetery, but they don't own it. And most of them don't own it. I can't speak for all, but most of them don't own it, and they could not sell it. So,
thank you very much. I think many of them are owned now by the counties in which they reside.
Although the counties might contest that.
I know. I agree. But, I mean, yeah. No private tax has been paid, a lot of cases, and other kinds of stuff.
You're
so
right.
So what has happened is they've kind of come back to the counties, whether they wanted to have them back or not.
And there's always the issue of whether or not the individual grave sites are technically owned by the descendants.
Correct.
Too.
Yeah, so. if they paid for them. I know that this has been a fairly large issue in our area. We have a lot of small communities that at different times were fairly large communities in and around Coos Bay, and each one of them has their own cemetery, and most of the groups have not set up nonprofits, but the person who lives in the adjoining property, when they buy the house, they kind of get told that they also have the cemetery. So I know that as a club advisor, our kids... whose kids were the ones that next door, the parents got the club to come up and take care of the cemetery. And we actually have a cemetery on the campus at Marshfield High School. It's owned by the city, but it's a fairly large pioneer cemetery right on the hill in Coos Bay. And we had a young freshman who decided that, Ms. Soles, who decided she was going to take over that cemetery and get it fixed up. So she identified all the Civil War veterans. She has identified all the veterans, replaced tombstones, because there's national organizations where you can send, and they will send you back the new
tombstones.
The Veterans
Administration will provide markers.
It's been an amazing thing to watch, and it's added a lot to the community. We've always used that as an interesting addendum to our history classes, but it's been pretty exciting.
A great project.
Yes.
Another question, if I might, Mr.
Yep.
Chair.
Please.
So, the purpose for having a nonprofit corporation to provide this maintenance and oversight is so that people who pay money to help do this get a tax deduction, or is there some other reason for the nonprofit corporation to exist?
Well, occasionally, I'm not sure that I really know the answer to your question, but occasionally someone will leave a bequest of quite a bit of money, $25,000, $50,000, for the care of that cemetery. And
So it's to then be custodian of those funds?
It's an organization so somebody doesn't walk away with the funds.
The other thing is that it's possible then to apply for grants, which you would not be able to do under other circumstances. And grants can provide monies for preservation or, stone repair, just many, many other kinds of things like that. Hmm. And so that's an advantage.
Yes. Chair Robel and Representative Nolan. I guess the other option for individuals would be to be a unincorporated association. And this is a non-registered business entity, but I think it starts to run into some of those issues as far as recognition by grant writing associations or the IRS. It's just an association of individuals, so it really doesn't have the same type of a focus as a separate entity, which a nonprofit corporation is. So the nonprofit corporation can hold and control assets in perpetuity beyond the individuals who are serving as directors or officers.
Along that questioning, do we have a history of when they started making these nonprofit organizations to run? Because I don't think that's been, they haven't been happening for a long time, have they?
For the cemeteries?
Chair Roblin,
the nonprofit corporations that are that we've set up to
we've had nonprofit corporations in Oregon since prior to statehood
for these historic
and
cemeteries.
And some of our cemetery corporations are
okay.
over 100 years old.
Okay, that's interesting to know.
Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Nolan,
understanding that. There are different locations and local community attachments. Have you looked at any kind of consolidation to have an umbrella to provide some safekeeping for funds and resources, but to streamline some of the administrative cost of managing this stuff? I mean,
as far as our organization goes, we're all volunteers too, and everything we do is out-of-pocket expense. So I don't know that that's something that would be possible for us.
Well, I actually think that the Oregon Commission on Historic Cemeteries is trying to provide and has provided a great deal of help and information to groups throughout the state. I don't know about streamlining costs, but we have talked about the possibility of, you know, if somebody needs gravel or something like that, you know, if they're all close together, can we get a big load? But, you know, I mean, we're talking really, for most of these cemeteries, it's really a, they're just not very large, and
yeah.
And because of the all volunteer nature of almost of many of them, now not all of them, but many of them, it would be difficult.
However, we do what we can, and specifically answering your question is that our organization, because we are a nonprofit, has in the past taken on about $25,000 and banked it and kept it on our books separately for a year or two until the association for the association could be formed and get its nonprofit status and its IRS status for the particular cemetery that this money was intended for. So we can provide that service to people, but we certainly don't have the volunteer staff to do it on a statewide basis.
Mr. Chair, I can appreciate that, and I'm actually very supportive of the efforts around the sesquicentennial and the preservation of historic reminders for us all, but it is not without cost to the corporation division to manage all of this paperwork. And if there were a way to take 120 of these cemeteries and have them incorporated in one place because there is de minimis activity there, and then the ones that actually have activity maybe even have a budget beyond $50 a year. I want to appreciate not burdening the volunteers, but I also don't want to burden the public employees who actually have to spend time processing all this paper as well.
Chair Robel and Representative Nolan, I think for the 150 filings a year that we're looking at, that's a very absorbable cost for us. We're probably doing on order of 225,000 documents a year. So that would just be a few minutes in a day's worth of our activity to bring that in. So we wouldn't want to...
As long as we don't get to the point that Representative Garrard was trying to raise of whether we've let the camel's nose under the tent.
Right. And I agree. I mean, we've looked at this one over that period of years, and I do understand those concerns, and we would like to see it kept to at least this particular instance, just this specific purpose.
And the other part of that one is each one of these, because they are a nonprofit, does have an annual report to fill out to send to you. So you have 150 reports every year to look at. I think that's part of what Representative Nolan was also getting at. And there's somebody that has to fill out one of those reports and make sure it gets in, or if they don't in 5 years, they go away. And then they don't realize they've gone away, and then they have to... So all of the bills today that we've talked about really have some interrelatedness to them, and they do each have expenses that are...
One of the things that we do, that our office does, when individuals call, and I've spoken with folks before that said, here's this idea, I really don't know how to go about starting a nonprofit, but I think this is important and something I'd like to do. And usually our first response is, well, have you checked, and is there anybody else that's already providing the same service in the state? And perhaps you could just volunteer and join forces with them, as opposed to just starting up your own corporation that has all of its own overhead, because even beyond the $50, you're going to have those new tax filing statements with the Internal Revenue Service. You have to hold annual meetings. You have to elect officers. You have to do a number of different activities. So,
and as we have pointed out, 550 others are not using that tool to get their work done. Okay, any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony, and it is very much appreciated. And I just want to speak, I think, for all the people up here. We appreciate all the work that these commissions and societies are doing to preserve this history that we get to celebrate the 150th years. And many of the cemeteries have many people buried before that. They were identified before as we were a territory. And the cemeteries go back farther than 150, but it's important. And I think everybody here acknowledges the importance of it. Just figuring out how to do it best would be helpful. In Representative Edwards' words, as long as we can find some money or not spend it, helpful for all of us.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
I would just like to commend the city or the community of Coos Bay, where you were referring to the cemetery that they have, the historic registered cemetery. my great-grandmother's sister and her parents, which would be my great-grandmother or other, are buried in your fair community.
Oh, okay.
In that.
Okay.
So I would appreciate it if you would
have to go stop by sometime.
That it is kept up.
Get some flowers. Yeah, we'll work on that one. Yes. Thank you.
Cheers.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Representative Jensen was one of the few members of this committee who actually was a state representative prior to 1909.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that part of being a nonprofit is also providing education. And that's one of the things that the cemetery in the Marshfield High Cemetery has done a marvelous job in providing materials for other young people to use to possibly adopt a cemetery or help. So,
yeah, it was funny. One of the first things I found was the principal. I mean, I had worked there for a long time, and I knew the cemetery was there, and we had our issues, but I didn't realize that the keeper of the record of where each of the plots were and who was there was the secretary for the principal that had that, and she had the key to get everybody in. So it was one of the jobs as you got to know who everybody was out there. It made our population of the high school a little larger, and, you could always say cute little things like, I don't know what happened to the last student that did that, but we do have a cemetery.
And a wonderful way to avoid some of the vandalism that we see.
That's
twice,
true.
Hillsborough Pioneer Cemetery has twice in the past 4 or 5 years have somebody come through and knock over 80 stones, which is...
Right. And sadly, that has happened at that cemetery as well. Though the thing that's interesting, the more the kids take it part in it and fix it, the less likely that is to happen, and the more likely it is that we'll find out who it was that did it, because they are not appreciative of that behavior. So,
and
yeah, I agree.
Cemeteries that are kept up usually have less vandalism.
That's absolutely true.
No doubt.
Oh, Representative Gelser.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank you for your work. We have in my family, we have a special place in our hearts for historic cemeteries, because the first house that we purchased was adjacent to one. So when I woke up in the morning and gazed out the window at the lovely tombstones, or as I rocked my baby to sleep at nighttime looking out at the tombstones, we quickly learned that they're nice places to live next to. And when we purchased the house, the previous owners let us know that the neighbors were very quiet and that they did not cause a lot of problems.
Though an interesting thing...
We were relieved to hear that.
The interesting thing we found out is that Earth does not just stay where it is. It does move. And you have to be careful about
yes.
where you thought the cemetery were and where you thought the people who were buried there are, because they don't always, they move. So you might have had some neighbors that were closer than you thought you were.
Thank you.
So thank you. No other comments. I will close the hearing on House Bill 2087, and we'll open a public hearing. Oh, there wasn't anyone. Was there anyone else? I forgot that. No, that's good. Won't have to open it up. We'll open... a public hearing on House Bill 2090. And with that, a short statement by our administrator.
This measure changes ORS 194.070 to allow notary publics to protest commercial paper only if the notary is an officer or employee of a financial institution or financial company, or a member of the Oregon State Bar, or serves under supervision of one of those people. Notary protest is a provision of law that creates a mechanism to demand payment of promissory notes, unpaid checks, and other payment instruments through the presentment of the item. Proponents of this bill assert that the original purpose of protest was to facilitate banking transactions, and that the continued appropriate use of that mechanism primarily involves banking and investment institutions. The Secretary of State advises notaries public that protesting commercial paper is a complex process and is only appropriate when completed as part of an official banking act. Opponents assert that despite such advice, notary protest has been misused in recent years to harass public officials, including judges, corrections officials, and law enforcement officials.
Thank you very much. With that, I think we'll invite the Secretary of State's office to make a few comments.
For the record, Chair Roble and members of the committee, my name is Peter Threlko. I'm the Director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's Office. House Bill 2090 deals with a very archaic process in banking that allows a bank or someone that's owed a check or a negotiable instrument to collect payment on that if the instrument was first dishonored. This really goes back to the days when banks actually cleared their checks, those paper checks, by presenting them to the banks that they were drawn on. I used to work for a regional bank for about 12 years, and one of the things that our bank and other banks had to do, if a customer got a check and the check was drawn on the East Coast, they would bring that into the bank, they'd cash it, and part of the bank's responsibility was to then make sure that check got on a semi-truck that was going to the East Coast, got back to the bank it was drawn on, and then eventually made its way into the monthly statement for the customer that wrote the check. If along the way the check came back non-sufficient funds, it would make its way back across the country, and the person that it had been written to would then have some process, either through the bank or through a notary public, to be able to try to demand and collect payment on that item.
over the last decade or so, banks have gone to optical scanning and imaging of checks. So paper checks are no longer transported. It's that image that goes across country. The process has increased dramatically and is a lot more efficient. And really the call and the demand for doing a notarial protest of commercial paper is almost non-existent these days for the legitimate purpose or use of it. What we've seen the last couple of years is a growth by adoption and an adaptation of folks in the anti-government or sovereign citizen movement to use this process as a way to harass judges, corrections officials, tax authorities. And what they will do is they will present them a list of demands. When the officials fail to respond to that list of demands, they'll say, well, they'll send them another letter, and they'll accept for value your non-compliance or your non-response. Generally, they'll attach a sum of $200 million or billions of dollars as to the value that they're now demanding for your failure to reply to their initial list of demands. They'll bring in a notary public. They'll have a notary do a commercial protest of commercial paper and help facilitate this process. It's a bit of a back and forth, often referred to in some circles as paper terrorism. It's generally a scheme to either cause a public official to not prosecute or fulfill their duties. And it's becoming more and more of a problem both in Oregon and California and many other states. What we're seeing, surprisingly or not surprisingly, is that in our prison institutions, this is very popular. As I've talked to folks in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, they tell me that the only people that are in the prison are those that are innocent and those that were framed. So, if you look at the second page of my testimony, is actually a letter from U.S. Federal or Department of Justice Counterterrorism Unit for the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And he's alerting us to some problems with an Oregon notary who is trying to facilitate a number of transactions with a federal inmate, and that federal inmate is perpetrating the notarial protest of commercial paper against both a federal judge and a regional corrections officer for some perceived grievances. And trying to either get out of jail or cause some other course of action that he doesn't feel that the Department of or the Bureau of Prisons and the judge are abiding by, that the way he thinks the world should be. What we've tried to allow for in the bill is that those legitimate uses still have a way that they can be accomplished, and we do that by continuing to allow notaries who are working for a financial institution, whether that be a state or federal chartered bank or a investment company, that those individuals, those officers who are notaries or notaries who work for those individuals, are still able to perform the notarial protests of commercial paper. We also would include any active member of the Oregon State Bar or any notaries that work under their supervision, that they would also be able to take care of these financial transactions. We think that that's a broad enough group that any, although seldom ever legitimate use, but any legitimate use could still be facilitated through the process. What that would allow us to do is then shut down the inappropriate use, and we would also be able to then go and revoke the commissions of notaries that fail to heed our warnings and continue to work with groups to basically perpetuate these harassment schemes. So if you have any questions.
Okay. Questions? Representative Gerard.
I'm just curious. You have attached here a lot of letters that Karen L. Tappert, a notary public, wrote. Those are difficult enough to read. So I'm wondering if you would interpret what was she trying to do with these corrections and serving a district judge with her notary public.
Chair Roblin, Representative Gerard. It's really as part of this. This is a part of the process for the protest of commercial paper. So a lot of times, and my office gets the initial requests a lot of times, and it'll be 53 different citations. If you were to look up on the internet common law movement or straw man, some different searches, you'd eventually come across some templates. And these templates say, these are the things that you go out if you've got a tax authority that sent you a tax bill. Instead of paying your bill, send them back this letter, require that they tell you, you know, their constitutional authority, their legislative authority, their, you know, in the case of a judge, their oath of office. That's a real big common theme for the judges, is that there's an invalid oath of office, and they want to basically bury the government agency in paperwork so that they won't they'll either, you know, hopefully that the government would leave you alone and let you go about, do your business, not pay your taxes, let you out of jail. And so then by your non-response, then they'll send you another demand notice. They'll say, well, if you don't respond, I'm going to accept your non-response as a commercial transaction, which it's not, but in their mind it is. It's hard to explain, because there's a certain reliance on letting go of a suspension of disbelief that is required to really buy into some of these concepts and schemes. And generally, the folks that fall for it, they're in desperate situations, we find, for a lot of people. And there's groups of people that are out there that for $1,500 or $2,500 will teach you their secrets if you attend their seminar. And so those are the folks that, when the IRS and the federal prosecutors really look at trying to address some of these situations in these areas, they're generally going after the ones that are the purveyors and that try to solicit just desperate people to fall for these schemes. So they're, you know, anything from Posse Comitatus to Montana Freeman to a lot of the different fringe groups that we've seen here in Oregon and many other states, that this is all sort of wrapped together. And it's primarily is just a methodology or a mindset to thwart the legitimate powers of government. I don't think that there are any of the individuals here to testify. They actually don't recognize your authority.
So this is a way to harass the government.
It's a way to harass the government.
What a concept.
Other questions?
Thank you, buddy.
Is there anyone in the audience that is dying to speak to this House bill? I see no one else. So I thank you for your testimony, and we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2090. Having checked with the office and the clerk. We can pass out HJR 8 today. We have it posted as a work session. What will happen is that we can make it a special order of business on the 12th, so there's a process we go through at the next level to move it forward to the 12th, and we would then therefore have it ready to go on that date if we so desire. And so I checked with everybody, most everybody, and I think we're all ready to go. So we're going to open a work session on HJR 8.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'll go. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move House Joint Resolution 8 to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation from this committee.
Representative Berger has moved that HJR 8 be passed to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation, or do-pass, whichever it is. And
it's a do-adopt.
Is there any discussion?
Yes. A brief comment. I think it's a good House Joint Resolution. It would be better if it also took on the issue of our state motto, which is just the Union, which was certainly a good thing back in the day, but just the Union doesn't really say much about this great state of ours. So, but it's a great.
You didn't want us to be part of the Union?
No, I wanted to be part of the Union. I just don't think it should be our state motto.
Oh, okay.
So.
Mr. Chair, I don't think it is anymore.
I thought it was she flies on her...
I think you're right.
I think we changed our motto to she flies on her own wings.
Well, that's good to know.
Okay.
Did I retract my comments?
The hard part of it is that it didn't come off the seal and stuff, so I understand that that's probably true.
Okay.
And speaking of that seal...
Representative Gelser, do you have a question or a comment? Did I see your hand? Okay. Any other discussion with regard to HJR 8? Seeing none, we might as well get on the record here. We'll have a roll call vote.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye.
It passes, and the next thing is the assignment of a carrier. I think Representative Olson, I will ask him. I don't think he will decline. So,
you have to grow a beard first.
I will mention that that was not the requirement. You have to find a co-carrier who has a beard so that he can't grow his own.
Shock or Olson.
No, I'm sorry. It's just... any other business that people have before this group? It looks as if the future, there is a Friday. We have a possible meeting of a joint meeting of the House.
That would be Wednesday the 18th.
Oh, Wednesday. Oh, good. I'm happy to hear that.
Wednesday,
so Wednesday the 18th, a joint.
Oh, 2 weeks from now.
2 weeks from now. meeting. We have a person visiting from, I'm trying to remember all this stuff. I'll get the information out to everyone.
I'm not sure where
from. Yeah. So, and we'll be doing a joint meeting at that time during our regular session with the Senate as well. So, and we'll keep you apprised of that. Yes?
Rather than where, the person is from the Help America Vote Association.
Okay. So, with that, pardon?
18th.
This is with who?
Help America
Vote Association.
Okay.
With that, we will adjourn today's Rules Committee. Thank you very much for all being here.